When our best fur friends leave our world, many of us are left wanting one last scritch, one last hug, one last walk together. One Last Network is a space for pet guardians to honor their pets in their senior years and to cope with the days leading up to and after their passing. Here's your host, Angela Schneider, founder of One Last Network and Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington.
Back with Dr. Kyle Boland from the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. Last week, we talked about the behavioral issues that seem to have become more common in our companion animals. Today, we're exploring the complex issue of behavioral euthanasia. We talk about the signs that might prompt such a decision and the factors involved in the process. Dr. Boland emphasizes the importance of considering our pet's quality of life and safety along with the quality of life and safety of the humans who share the home. Dr. Boland highlights how the decision to euthanize on the basis of behavioral issues requires teamwork from the pet guardian and their veterinarian. Have a listen.
Now, as we turn towards more of a darker subject when it comes to behavior in dogs, are there specific signs or behaviors that you should look for that would prompt the process toward behavioral euthanasia? One of the cases that really comes to mind for me is the Michael Vick case, where some of the dogs needed to be euthanized right away while others were able to be rehabilitated and go on to live long, happy couch potato lives. What was the difference there with, you know?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I hadn't thought about that case for a really long time. I think there's a lot of also still misnomers about that case, because, you know, the truth of that case is the ASPCA was involved in that case. And so if you take an organization like the ASPCA, they have an entire center for dog rehabilitation, right? It's in North Carolina. They have PhD behaviorists on staff. They have DVMs, you know, veterinarians. Now the ASPCA employs a board certified veterinary behaviorist. And so we look at that case, and I think on some level it kind of did some bad in the fact that it kind of gave people the idea that, wow, can every dog be rehabilitated? Like, even if these, you know, fighting dogs, we can save some of these fighting dogs, then I can do that too. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of those dogs had suffered profound trauma. Some were not recoverable, but the ones that did move on, I don't have follow-up, but I do think that nothing was perfect. It wasn't live happily ever after. It was go to these homes with tons of management and maybe lots of avoidance of different things. And maybe, you know, not, I'm sure not every case, you know, had even a happy ending after that. But even the cases that did go into homes, they didn't just say, okay, we're going to go into this home and here you go, we're going to, you know, rehabilitate this, you know, pit bull type dog. They had extensive resources at their backs to get them to that point, which most clients are not going to be able to do. If you take the ASPCA Rehab Center, I've not visited before, but I know the things they do. They, you know, they're working with the dogs, you know, all the time, right? They're professional trainers, PhD behaviorists, veterinarians. They're on different medications, and so that, set some of those dogs up for success. But I don't know that that's a model that is highly replicatable for the average person, because I think when we think about behavioral euthanasia, one of the things that comes to the table is a lot of guilt and shame. And people think, what have I done wrong? And what could I have done different? When in fact, a lot of these dogs come to the table with a lot of problems that we as humans, maybe the humans currently, didn't have control over. Mm-hmm. So when we look at things like, okay, so let's, you know, take a case in our clinic, you know, what would prompt us to then think about something like a behavioral euthanasia versus, say, another dog where it might not come up? Well, the first thing is we ask the owner, because every appointment we have a questionnaire, and you have to fill out the questionnaire to get scheduled. And so at the end of that questionnaire, we actually ask, have you considered rehoming your pet? And have you considered euthanasia for your pet? And so some people will mark no, and some people will mark yes for various things. And so right on at the beginning, we're setting that seed to know that there are options out there. And by and large, this is a largely owner-driven conversation. And so when I have a client come to me with their dog with profound behavior problems, usually if it's kind of something they're thinking about, it's usually something that they would bring up to me because something's gone wrong. Either A, there's some major safety problems, or B, there's quality of life issues for the humans in the house, or B, or C, sorry, there's quality of life issues for the pet in the house. There are certain cases where it may have not been on the owner's or the client's radar screen, and I have had to bring it up as maybe for the first time the owner hasn't thought about it. I'd say those are fairly rare where we get a case that somebody hasn't at least thought about it in some of these more severe cases. And sometimes it's broached by the primary care veterinarian first. To be a little bit more specific in terms of the things that we look for, when I look for a dog or cat with a behavior problem, and a lot of times we're talking about dogs just because we see mostly dogs, about 90% of our cases are dogs versus 10% cats. And with a dog, I look at, is the trigger predictable? Is it avoidable? And then what is the actual reaction? So what's the level of reaction? What's the level of aggression? And so we used to see dogs that have aggression to things that are unpredictable, unavoidable, and then their response is a maladaptive response. It's an exaggerated response. It might be multiple bites in one setting. It might be a bite that breaks skin. Those are the things that I get really concerned about in terms of my ability to manage that dog safely in any home, let alone a quote unquote normal home, right? That might have other pets, that might have people, that might have visiting, that might have, kids in the house. And so, you know, wants to have people over for Thanksgiving. And so even in the perfect situation, if we're reaching those three things, that becomes very difficult for me as a clinician to manage safely. And so sometimes I have to have that conversation with a client that says, okay, here's what your dog's bringing to the table. How can I come up with a plan to keep everybody as safe as possible? And sometimes I do have to tell people that there is no plan to keep you or your dog safe in this moment. And so sometimes then that leads us down to the path of behavioral euthanasia because I don't have a medication that I can give them that's going to make everything safe. I don't have a management tool that's going to make everything safe, or I don't have a training tool that's going to make everything safe. And then we have to be and this is difficult for me because I'm an internal optimist, but we have to be the pessimistic person in the room. We have to be the doomsayer in the room that says, well, what's the worst thing that could happen, right? If it's a three-year-old and a bite to their face or their lip, you know, something like that, well, then that's really bad. If it's maybe a growl and a snap, that's the worst that's happened so far. Okay, we've got some places to work with on that. But if we're worried about things like biting multiple times or biting to a severe degree, we get really concerned about those things. So sometimes, even with those circumstances, people aren't quite ready for behavioral euthanasia. So we just do our best. And what's that look like? Well, it looks like medications. I mean, medications can certainly help increase the fuse. They can certainly help improve safety. They can improve quality of life. They can decrease anxiety, decrease irritability. We can address any chronic issues like allergies and pain or gastrointestinal problems that might be few shortening factors. We do as much avoidance as possible. So, you know, for example, if your dog is aggressive over a food bowl, okay, that's relatively predictable. Might not be avoidable, right? We could scatter treats outside. We could do food puzzle toys, but that might be the same thing, but relatively predictable. So we can manage something like that. But we do see cases that have profound aggression with unpredictable triggers and unavoidable triggers. And those are my most concerning things that we talk about behavioral euthanasia with. Certainly not the only cases, but those reach the top.
Do you have defined levels of reactivity? And then how do those levels affect your recommendation to euthanize?
We don't. I think a lot of these things are still fairly subjective. We certainly have bite scales that are out there. And whenever we look at that, that's probably one that I reach for the most is, okay, when we're looking for a bite that breaks skin, and then certainly multiple bites in one incident, those reach right there to the top of, okay, that's, we're hard stop here. We're pretty safe, unsafe. So what do we have to do to get people safe or keep the dog safe or other pets safe in the home? So a bite scale can be helpful, but every case is so individualistic, so nuanced, that it really takes a collaborative approach with the owner to come up with, okay, here's my dog's triggers. Here's the things that the dog presents. Here's the thing that the environment presents. Here's the things that we can do about it. Is this going to be a tenable situation? So sometimes we talk about non-overlapping Venn diagrams. So for example, do we have a dog that has profound separation anxiety that also has aggression to unfamiliar people? Okay. So if I have a dog that's aggressive to an unfamiliar person, okay, that's relatively predictable. It is predictable. You know, maybe some people have random guests show up, but you can do things like put signs on the door, you know, keep your doors locked. So that's relatively predictable, relatively avoidable, right? If a guest come over, call or text ahead of time, okay, I'm going to put the dog in a bedroom. I'm going to close the door. I'm going to put a baby gate up. I'm going to put a sign up. I'm going to put some white noise, play some music for the dog, give it a food puzzle toy, put it in the bedroom. Okay. So now I'm avoiding that problem. I can predict that problem. But then what happens if the dog has profound separation anxiety and it panics and it defecates and it whines and it actually self-harms itself trying to escape that door? Well, now we have a person, human, family member that's basically living trapped in their own home because they can't leave the dog, can't have guests over. And so then we get to, now we've got a human quality of life problem. So whenever I look at these issues, I look at multiple things. Of course, I'm a veterinarian, so I treat the dog or the cat or the patient, but you don't treat them in a vacuum. You treat them in an environment. And so the family brings things to the table. So I have to treat them within that family environment. And I have to make sure the humans have a good quality of life. And then I also think about the other pets in the home, if there are other pets. And then I think about public health too. As a veterinarian, every veterinarian takes the oath to protect public health. So if I have a dog that's really, really unsafe, sometimes there's a public health cause for behavioral euthanasia as well. That, you know, sometimes we just can't manage a dog tightly enough. And we can certainly do our best, but sometimes there are real public health concerns too.
So I, as a dog owner, have reached my breaking point. I haven't been working with someone as wonderful as you in a collaborative approach to attempting to modify my dog's behavior. How do I start that conversation with my vet? Or how do I get, what do I have to do to prevent getting to that breaking point? What does that breaking point look like? And then how do I start the discussion with my vet?
That's a good question. So first of all, I think I'd recognize that that's a great place to start. is your veterinarian, right? They should know your pet pretty well. They should know you pretty well if you know you've been a client there for a while. We sadly, we're still working through some misconceptions and some bias in our own community about behavioral euthanasia. So I still get pets referred to me that on paper, it's not a tough decision. Like we've got profound aggression, we've got kids in the home, we've got other comorbidities, we can't rehome. Like we've got a dog on paper that's just checking every box in terms of like this is not a tenable or a even remotely safe situation. And I usually come back to kids because that's usually these cases usually involve kids. And I've had a few cases in the last few years still where it's like, well, I'm not going to talk to you about this, but you need to see OSU behavior. And so that's well and fine. And I'm happy to be that person that talks them through that decision-making process. But the downside is we currently have a three or plus month wait list. And so, right, so making that person wait 3 months to come have a what we call a permission to euthanize appointment, where it's like, yes, this is an untenable situation. Yes, we have these tools, but they're not going to be enough in this for this dog. So I want to recognize that, yes, veterinarians are a great first point of contact. They should know your dog, they should know you. And the other thing that they can do is they can help address underlying medical problems, because that's going to be our first question that we ask. You know, what is contributing to these behavior problems? What is, you know, is it chronic pain, which we see a ton of? We see the big three. So chronic pain, gastrointestinal disease, and chronic allergies or itching. So those three things come to the table for a pretty large percentage of our patients. And so those are things that can be treated that potentially can lengthen a fuse. So in other words, they can decrease irritability and improve behavior. So that's something that the primary care veterinarian should be addressing as well. So I think people should just come out and say, hey, look, I've got, you know, this dog Fluffy, and me and Fluffy are struggling right now. And veterinarians, you know, by and large, they get into this profession to help people and to help animals. And so my hope is that they get an empathetic ear and they can help them get started on things. A lot of veterinarians are comfortable nowadays starting a pet on a behavior medication and starting them on some basic management techniques to at least make sure the problem's not going to get worse and keep people safe until they can get referred to us. So, if veterinarians are listening and they, you know, want to do best by their patients, I always recommend they have a good positive reinforcement based, well-educated scientific based trainer to refer to as well, because those folks can be invaluable for veterinarians and often can do a lot of good for patients, for clients, and get things started before they come see us.
I love the idea of building a team, not just for your own dog's healthcare, but also within the community of pet-related verticals that can all work together to improve the lives of our companion canines. How does the behaviorist, the trainer, or the vet start the conversation with the client that it might be time?
So how I approach this is the first and foremost is we're going to take a really detailed behavioral and medical history. So that's going to include probably lab work if it's safe to get a detailed medical history and veterinary records, and then a very detailed behavioral history. And then after that, I often pause and I take a deep breath. And I'll take a deep breath and I'll say, wow, that's a lot. And I recognize that people come to the table and they will come with a lot of exasperation, and stress, losing sleep, and worry about their pet. And so I first try to be empathetic and recognize what they've been facing. Then that my next course is to say, wow, that is a lot. Let's kind of talk about our options. Let's see what we can do. And so we basically kind of go through the three big options. Is okay, well, we can try to treat this. We can keep Fluffy in your home. And here's our treatment options. We can always pursue rehoming if that's a viable option. We can talk about what that means and when that is and is not viable. And then we have this, the other option, which is behavioral euthanasia. And sometimes if option A and option B aren't safe or fair to the pet, then we move to option C. And then I often talk to owners about the reasons for that. So I go back to those things about talking about prognosis, about predictability, about avoidance, about level of aggression. And I try to, I walk them through a plan in the room. And I say, well, this is potentially what a plan could look like. But even with this plan, we have pretty significant risk for, let's say, aggression. That's a common one. And so I just try to walk them through what that looks like. And then together we come to that decision. It's not always aggression. There's things like noise phobia. There's things like separation anxiety that that might not present a public health risk to a human, but presents a profound quality of life risk to the pet and potentially the owner. So that can come to the table as well. But so many clients are empathetic, and in today's world, we see, you know, lots of negative things on the news and, you know, things that divide us. And one of the things that I see is people come with their pets as they want to do better, and they're very empathetic. And so they come to the table, and they're oftentimes selfless, and they really think about their pet. And I'm a veterinarian, and I want to think about their pet, and I want to treat their pet. But I move it back to the human aspect, because that's a big part of the equation. So, you know, I try to get people to understand, like, hey, you seem to be struggling today too. Like, it must be hard not to get more than 4 hours of sleep at a time because your pet's waking up, you know, in the middle of the night every night. Or it must be hard to live on the edge of your seat all the time, knowing that, you know, is this going to be the day where my pet bites me again? That's unfair. And I often tell people that personally, as a veterinarian who treats behavioral problems, I wouldn't want to live like that. Like, that's like, I couldn't live like that. Like, that's really hard to do. And so they'll think about, like, wow, if, you know, this guy at least has some knowledge of animal behavior, you know, if he, you know, might not be able to deal with these issues. Wow, then it kind of gives them a little bit of relief of that burden, like, wow, if I've not done enough, or I can't do this, or things like that. So it's a lot of factors that we talk about. I also have the luxury of having a veterinary social worker that works for Ohio State. And so I often involve her in our conversations as well. So she's a human health professional. And so she helps me tackle some of the human health, mental health issues involved in these things, and helps clients make those decisions. Because sometimes we have clients that aren't on the same page, and that can be really difficult when two pet parents aren't on the same page about where to move forward. So she can definitely help as well. So it's a very collaborative conversation. We talk about the prognosis, we talk about what it looks like to treat, and we talk about the options. And then when we get to those other options that people, you know, the sometimes less good options, even though it might be best for the pet and the people, the rehoming or the euthanasia, we talk about what that looks like too. So, you know, what would rehoming look like for Fluffy? Well, in some cases, hey, your dog has been aggressive in only one situation. It has some resource guarding. You have a 2-year-old, toddler and a 4-year-old in the house. It's really, really hard to, as a parent, I know that that's really hard. So maybe Fluffy's just going to do better in a home without children. Is that perfect? No. Do people then decide to have kids later? Do they have grandkids that visit? Do they see kids out in the neighborhood? Yes, of course. But oft sometimes that can be an avenue of, so okay, well, rehoming is actually an option for this pet for this reason. And then we do talk about euthanasia and what it actually looks like. Some people have gone through that with their pet, and some people haven't. So we'll talk about what that means for them.
I'm glad to hear that you have access to a social worker to assist. One of my questions was going to be what kind of support and services can be provided to a client. I know I have been very fortunate to have two very perfect dogs, but when my first when it was time for him to go, it was a very it still is. It's been 9 years. It's still a very emotional time in my life, a lot of turmoil, a lot of trauma for myself. But so I can't possibly imagine the emotional turmoil, the pain, the grief that people who have to make these decisions for a perfectly healthy dog are going through. How do we manage those emotions, and how does a vet who doesn't have access to a social worker talk their client through that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I would first just push back a little bit on the notion that these pets are perfectly healthy. That's actually something I talk a lot about to my clients in terms of, these are we call them behavioral disorders. And so these are psychiatric illnesses, if you will, mental health disorders. So unfortunately, we don't have the sophistication to say, well, let's do this blood test or let's do this MRI and let's pinpoint where serotonin, for example, has gone wrong in your brain, and let's, where has the genes gone wrong? But we know that on a kind of a neurochemical level, from just a brain functional anatomy level, there is pathology. So there's going to be, and I tell people that this is abnormal. I use that phrase a lot. This is abnormal behavior. This is pathologic behavior. And so that's one of the things that oftentimes helps people, because when we say perfectly healthy, it's like, well, then I'm kind of killing a perfectly healthy dog. And I just push back on that. I want to say, well, this dog has a mental health disease or illness, if you will. And so and here's the thing that I don't think a lot of clients grasp. Just like with a cancer or certain heart diseases or chronic kidney disease, those can all be progressive, despite thousands of journal articles published every year, despite chemotherapy, despite all of the different treatments we have. Those are often progressive illnesses. So if we look at a behavioral disorder, it's no wonder that, yeah, sometimes we have a behavioral disorder that progresses, that gets worse, despite best treatment, despite everything you're doing, despite good training, despite medications, despite management. So that's one of the things that I talk to people a lot about in terms of just reframing the conversation in terms of how we talk about behavioral euthanasia with support. So people, again, they do bring a lot of shame and guilt to this conversation. And I warn people about that, because you're going to post, you might post online, right? Or, people often say, hey, I've lost my dog. People do a Facebook post, a little memorial post. And that's when you have a behavioral euthanasia, that's complicated. And then there's always going to be people, well, I had a trainer and we put a shock collar on them and it fixed my dog, or it fixed my neighbor's dog, or it did this, or it did that. And so you're always going to get those people out of the woodwork. And my first response to that is, well, will you take the dog? And you know, and same response to us, if a veterinarian won't euthanize a dog that has aggression, well, will you take the dog, veterinarian? Because if you won't take the dog today and this dog's not safe, then you need to euthanize this dog because it's not safe. So if you wouldn't take the dog in your own home with your own set of circumstances, then let's not judge an owner for coming to the table with that. So resources. So we point, so first of all, our website's open, free to the public, and there are a lot of resources on our website. So that's a great place to start. We point to a Facebook community a lot called Losing Lulu. You might have heard of it, but it's a community of people who have gone through this decision to euthanize their pet for behavioral disorders. And then there are actual human mental health professionals, qualified human mental health professionals that help people process these things as well. So I typically share some of those resources, and I just talk to people that, just like with any grief, you know, I even often say, hey, today, when I do a behavioral euthanasia, today's probably not the hardest day. It might be tomorrow, might be 2 weeks from now, might be, you know, 9 years from now, might be years later. So, you know, I warn people that it isn't easy. Often people will come with, you know, guilt to the table. So I at the end of the day, I just try to be as supportive as possible, empathetic as possible, share as many resources as possible. You know, and then if they're struggling, I think they should reach out to a human mental health professional that specializes in pet loss and pet grief, which there absolutely are out there.
We cannot leave this conversation without talking about the impact it has on the veterinary world. We know that, and I just spoke with Dr. Leanna Titcomb a few weeks ago about the state of veterinary care. You take that home. You take your experiences every day home. How does that impact you? The idea of behavioral euthanasia, and what is your self-care routine?
One I'm working on. Yeah, that's a work in progress. So veterinarians, it's a tough world. You know, it's been publicized that we certainly have a high professional suicide rate. We're actually not the highest. That's a bit a misnomer. Unfortunately, human mental health or human doctors still have that, which is not a good record to have, as far as I know, that they have that top notch. But nothing wants somebody wants to win. But we certainly, as a community, are struggling. It's hard because there is a shortage of veterinarians right now, and that has led to almost a snowball effect because it's led to more burnout, and then people leave, and then there's fewer veterinarians, and then more burnout, and then people leave. And so I have such respect for my colleagues who work ER because there was, I can't remember the study, or maybe it wasn't a study, but maybe it was like a popular press article, but it basically did a calculation of how much death a ER veterinarian faces in a lifetime versus even a human hospice care worker, right? That works and sees death. That's all they do is help people through the dying process. And if you're an ER veterinarian, I mean, there are times when you might euthanize 10, 20 pets, right, in a shift, let alone a week, let alone a month. And so, yeah, that it can be really tough. I'm one that this is going to sound dark and odd, but behavioral euthanasias are my favorite appointments. And I don't I don't quite know why that is, but I as a veterinarian, we have that strong, we're the only people that can help end animal suffering and, you know, allow that peaceful death to happen. I just take a lot of honor in that.
Yeah. It's a privilege to allow an animal safe passage from a lifetime of suffering, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. And so for me, those, obviously it's raw because, you know, I'm definitely emotional about it, but, you know, for the, those are some of my favorite times with clients. And I think the harder times for a behavior clinician is, you know, we're managing difficult chronic illnesses where improvement is a gift. Like if we say take a behavior and if we do all the things right and we make a 50% progress, that's great. Like that's a win. Like, man, we made a 50% progress in 3 or 6 months. You know, whereas if you're an orthopedic surgeon and a dog breaks a leg, you fix the leg, they come back in 6 weeks for their radiographs and it's healed up. They release their exercise restrictions and they go on with their life. You know, so with these they're much more chronic. And then there is that human emotional aspect to it as well. And people bring that to the table. So we end up being, you know, part veterinarian, but part human, you know, health counselors. And I don't overstep, right? I very much do not want to be a human mental health counselor, but you still have to help people through tough times and process emotions about their pets. So we try to be as supportive as possible. So yeah, it can be a tough time to be a veterinarian, but we hope that the good days outweigh the bad and the good outcomes outweigh sometimes the not so good outcomes.
Bring us back to the light and tell us a story about a good outcome.
So one of my own dogs, I have 4 dogs at home and a cat, and I'm basically running a hospice center in my house because I have 4 dogs, 2 are 12 and 2 are 14, and my cat's 15.
Oh my.
So, yeah, so we have a lot of, you know, treatments going on at any given time. So anyways, one of my dogs is a 12-year-old pitty mix from our local shelter, and we adopted him at 16 weeks. So it kind of pulls us full circle because we had no control over his socialization period. And talk about trauma, he was left in a crate with his sibling, his brother, his litter mate, and found in an apartment abandoned. So who knows what, you know, Leo had for the first 4 months of his life, right? So he's 4 months, we get him, and this is 12 years ago, right? Before I was a veterinarian, before I was even thinking about behavioral medicine, before I knew anything. Like I was new, I had 2 dogs, but I didn't really do any formal training with them. Like I didn't know anything. So he starts to become, you know, reactive at a young age, like even 4 months, barking at people, barking at dogs. And so I start doing research, I start doing training and take him to a training facility. And the first thing they recommended, you know, the little plastic bottles of lemon juice, they're like, oh, pick up a little plastic thing of lemon. Anytime he barks, squirt that in his mouth. So the first week I forgot it, or conveniently forgot it, right? I didn't want to do it because I was like, this doesn't sit right for me. Like, I don't know a lot about dog behavior yet, but like, it didn't sit right. So yeah. Then the next week comes, and luckily another person had brought their bottle that I could borrow. So I was like, oh shoot. I was like, you know, I'm not really comfortable with this. So I ended up leaving the class and not coming back. But through that process, I got hooked up with some positive reinforcement based trainers in the community. And I started volunteering, and I had always had the bug of being a veterinarian when I was younger. And it's one of those things that's like, oh, you got to get top grades. You got to go shadow all this stuff. And I was almost just, you know, bogged down. I was discouraged by that. I was like, I just didn't think I could do it. And then I saw my wife graduate law school, pursue her dreams. I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to go back to vet school. And so I took prerequisites that I had none of, zero. My bachelor's degree, I had not taken one class I needed to get into vet school. So I went to the local community college, I took a bunch of classes, applied to Ohio State and got in. And throughout this process, I went to a veterinary conference and I saw that, oh, there's a veterinary behavior speaker. That's kind of cool. And I'm going to, you know, that's with behavior problems. I'm going to go see what that's about. And that clicked instantly. When I found you could do veterinary medicine and behavior together, that just clicked for me. And so we got Leo here to Ohio State. He saw one of our first residents we had Dr. Gilbert Gregory, who practices in New Jersey now. And she got him on medications. He takes Prozac as one of his medications and a few others. And he's come a long way, but he still struggles. Just this morning, I go downstairs. My wife said, "Hey, something's wrong with Leo." And I was like, "Hey, I know. I already gave him an extra pill for it because he was anxious today for whatever reason." But he has come leaps and bounds. He comes here, he gets rehab. And he enjoys visitors, and he used to be aggressive at the vet, fearful, anxious, barking, and he, loves people to come and say hi to him at the vet. And so now things have shifted for him because he's not young anymore. And so now he's dealing with, chronic pain. And so we're working through that. He's on different modalities for his chronic pain. And that's really the next evolution of what I'm doing Leo has really piqued my interest and he's moved my career because it was kind of got me into behavior. And then now he's got these chronic pain issues. And it's like, wow, I've been really reading and thinking more about those and how it impacts our patients and anxiety and behavior. And so I'm just kind of doing more into that and trying to, be as cognizant as I can as a veterinarian to treat underlying disease and underlying pain. And so I'd say Leo's a good testament to what can be done. I truly believe without medication, he would not be alive today. Like Leo cannot exist without his anti-anxiety medications. His quality of life would be really poor. Ours would be as well. But behavioral medications have saved his life. So I think he's a good example of what can be done.
And what an impact he's had on your life, because you might not be a veterinary today and speaking to me right here in this moment if it were not for Leo.
Yeah, I don't know. I truly don't know. So yeah, he's had a big impact.
Amazing. Dr. Bolin, what is one last piece of advice you can give to pet owners who are struggling with a pet exhibiting severe behavioral problems?
Don't trust the internet. Go to your veterinarian. It's real simple.
Oh, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. It's an easy route, though, isn't it?
It is. Yep. It is.
Thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. I appreciate you bringing this topic to light and having a chance to talk about it.
My misstep, which Dr. Bolin so gently corrected, is assuming these are, quote, perfectly healthy animals, unquote. They aren't. Much like humans may look physically healthy, there can be chemical imbalances or wires crossed on the inside, making for an unhealthy individual or dog or cat. In a world where our mental health assistance is scarce for humans, it becomes so much more important to treat each other and our companion animals with compassion and kindness. Don't forget to check the show notes for links to find more from Dr. Boland and the behavioral medicine team at Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. The Honoring the Bond section has several resources for you if you're considering behavioral euthanasia. I'm Angela Schneider, owner of Big White Dog Photography in Spokane, Washington, and your host at One Last Network, signing off to go get some Bella snuggles. Listen to One Last Network on whichever podcast platform you prefer. We're on Spotify, Apple, and Amazon. Don't forget to hit follow or subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And if you have a friend who might be interested in our content, make sure you share us with them. Thanks for listening.